Welcome to Primitive Moves, a podcast brought to you by Gettysburg College and Gettysburg Entrepreneurial Thinkers. I'm Marco Greenberg, author of Primitive, Tapping the Primal Drive that Powers the World's Most Successful People. On this podcast, I'm talking to the brightest minds in business to get their advice for students jumping into the job market and anyone at any point in their career journey. Here to help me are Professor Drew Murphy and a bunch of Gettysburg students. Today, we're talking to Greg Zuckerman, a special writer at the Wall Street Journal and the author of The Man Who Solved the Market. First, I get him talking about Jim Simons, who made billions of dollars by sparking the quantitative investing revolution. Then, because Greg's a journalist, he turns the tables and asks me to explain what it means to be a primitive. Together, we dive into the big lessons from both of our books, get into what big money is doing on Wall Street, and discuss his view on how you can recreate your own professional reputation on a daily basis. Here's author and journalist Greg Zuckerman. In the beginning of your book, you talk about the fact that this book was not a fait accompli. This was not a slam dunk in terms of you getting the permission, the cooperation to write it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So my book is about the most successful group of traders or investors in history, but they're also the most secretive. And they didn't want me writing this book. The key person at the firm, Jim Simons, not only did he not want to talk to me, but he told people not to talk to me. And I had a check. As a writer, you get it in advance. And then the first thing you do is you cash the check. But I had it here right on my desk in New Jersey for months, and I wouldn't cash it because I knew if I cashed it, I'd spend it. And if I spent it, I wouldn't be able to give it back. And I wasn't sure I could do this book, so I didn't want to cash that check. I wanted the ability to give it back. And then finally, someone from like the accounting department is like, Greg, what's going on with that check there? So eventually I did cash it. But yeah, I wasn't sure I'd get enough people to talk. And there's some lesson there for all of us, I think. If you're persistent enough and you work long enough and hard enough and don't mind people slamming the door and saying no, you get what you need.
Tell us more about this guy, Jim Simons. How much is he worth? What were the annual returns until last year? A lot of us haven't even heard the name, and you're about to tell us that this guy is a titan.
Yeah, so this guy, Jim Simons, is a fascinating, objectively fascinating individual. He's worth $25 billion. He today is, forget about just investing, he's a power in all kinds of different areas of society, which is why I wanted to write the book. The individuals I write about, not only were big investors, are big investors, but they impact us all. In terms of basic science, let's say, this guy, Jim Simons, is at the forefront of all kinds of research, autism research. He believes they're going to come up with treatments for autism in the next few years. He's at the center of an effort to figure out how the universe began. He's got this $75 million observatory in Chile, which is trying to figure out how the first moments of the world of life, what were they like? He subsidizes math and science teachers, public school teachers in New York State. He's very politically minded. He's one of the biggest donors to the Democrats, both this cycle and the last two cycles. I can go on and on. So he's a fascinating individual. And what he is a mathematician. He's one of the most important geometers over the past 1,500 years, a lot of important work. He ran SUNY Stony Brook's department for a while. He was a code breaker for the government. Then in 1978, a long time ago, he said, I'm giving all that up. I'm going to try to figure out how to find patterns in the market. And that's kind of what he set out to do. And it took him a long time. So you ask about returns. His average returns since 1988, when they renamed their firm and they started a different approach, is 66% a year before fees. It's absurd. And what they are is they're not flash traders. They're medium frequency, which basically means on average holding periods of a day or two. So they're short-term oriented traders. Both equities, about 60% of the returns are equities, but they do other stuff too, commodities and such. And it's all sort of fast trading, technical. They don't care about the fundamentals. They don't care about the names of the companies. People within the firm, they're mathematicians. They don't even know anything about these companies. So they'll make mistakes sometimes. They'll say, oh yeah, last week when they'll talk to outsiders. Oh yeah, for example, when you trade shares of Chrysler, and then people at the table are like, there's no Chrysler shares anymore, guys. So they show everything we all have been taught is for naught, or at least it's not their approach. There are other ways to make money. It's just not their approach.
And they're not the typical Wall Street guys, right? They did not, he didn't recruit from Goldman Sachs. He didn't recruit from Morgan Stanley. It's actually a very academic, scientific, mathematical culture that starts right there in Long Island at Stony Brook, which is in itself is unlikely.
That's exactly true. And he started in like the strip mall across from the train station in Long Island, out in Stony Brook. Yeah, they consciously don't hire from Wall Street. If you've been on Wall Street, they don't really want to see your resume. They instead will hire academics, mathematicians, and scientists. If you're a physicist, if you're an astronomer, they'd love to see your resume. I think one of the lessons there is there are unique outsider type approaches. They are the quintessential outsiders.
Exactly. So for those liberal arts majors at Gettysburg who think, you know what, maybe I don't have a place in Wall Street, time to think again. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy on what makes a good boss. And does anything you've learned by writing about Jim change your POV on that?
In my industry, we're all a little bit neurotic and insecure. Writers, we've got big egos. We don't care that much about money, which is why we go into this industry. We care about having an impact on the world, improving the world. We're idealistic in a lot of ways, but we've got egos. So in my world, the best editors are those that are excited by my ideas. When I present them with an idea, they get excited. It's not to say that they're not critical, but I'll send them an idea and they'll go, wow, that's great, Greg. Maybe you should think about this or try doing it that way. And I love that. And the worst bosses are those that I get really excited because we get pumped. We get ideas. I hear a story. Someone leaks me a document. Someone gives me a tip. I go straight to the editor. And the best feeling is when the editor gets excited. And the worst feeling is when they don't respond. And that's the worst. Just respond. Just give me a thought. Give me a critique. Tell me why it's not a good story. It's fine. I can take it, but take it seriously. So those are my thoughts. But I love to hear your thoughts.
Look, maybe it's a natural transition to some of the stuff that I wrote about in the primitive. But the first human being that I mentioned in the book is a former boss of mine at Burson Marsteller by the name of Michael Clays. And one of the things that immediately became apparent about Michael Clays was that he didn't manage people. He had no time for managing people. He was into being a hunter, getting the big game, going after the big clients and servicing them from consumer packaged goods companies like Clorox to foreign governments like Indonesia. And what I learned from that is, yes, there are hunters like Michael Clays, and then there are farmers who are more, in my lexicon, Greg, more civilized, people who are more grounded, who dot the I's and cross the T's and really work the process and know how to excel within the system, but they're not the non-conventionals. They're not the non-traditionals. They're not the mavericks. With Primitive, it really occurred to me that those are the people who make breakthroughs.
One thing that I thought was underlining your book, and I don't recall if you got into it, but was a sense of self-confidence that's necessary too, which Jim Simons had, and which frankly, I'm a self-confident guy, but nothing like Jim, and you can learn from that. And I thought maybe talk about, can one develop that self-confidence that you need to be primitive?
Some of it gets back to the adage of fake it till you make it.
Because
a lot of these people have a lot of swagger. They have a good rap. They have gravitas. They know how to command a room. And if they don't, they know that that's a weakness that they need to work on. What I do think, though, it's a bit of a yin-yang. Getting back to how you define reporters as being a little neurotic, a little bit insecure, you know, one of the things that I have in my book in the roaming acronym is I equals insecure. And these are people that embrace a healthy sense of paranoia, that don't walk around thinking it's all good. Instead, they feel that, you know, things could go haywire at any time. I've certainly seen that in people that I've worked with. And I've also seen, as of late, people being more candid about, quote unquote, outing themselves as having insecurity. Elon Musk is someone who comes to mind, right? Telling the New York Times, telling 60 Minutes, I'm too wired or anxious to even sleep. We have a former colleague in the book, Ricky Drury, who runs marketing for EMEA. That's Europe, Middle East, Africa, for those that don't know the acronym, for YouTube. She starts that chapter by saying, I'm the most insecure person I know. So I actually get a little nervous when people have too much bravado and they are less imposters. And imposters sometimes get a bad rap. There's a term that we talk about in the book that you might have seen called the Dunning-Kruger effect, coined by psychologists to describe people who think they're competent, but are actually highly incompetent. And when you get out of the workforce, I'm sure you've encountered some people like that.
I enjoyed very much the book, and I think everyone should read it. And there were all kinds of interesting people and in stories. But I thought your own was one of the best. Tell everyone about the story, because I could put myself in your shoes. You get this offer to come back to a huge firm, a big name firm. And I'm seeing you and your wife at the dinner table, and I'm thinking, I'm agreeing with her. It made sense to go back. Here you are getting more money, more prestige. You come back sort of a conquering hero. Tell us a little about that, and then tell us what happened, and maybe there's some lessons there.
I had had my own business, two incarnations thereof. It was 2008, 2009, and the economy was headed south very quickly. I got a big job offer to return to then the largest PR firm in the world, and I took it. I was reluctant about it because I knew in my core I was more of a free spirit. I hadn't at that time coined the term primitive. But I knew that I was someone who did it my way and had problems with some authority figures, let's say. And I like to be creative and I prefer the independence and control rather than the scope and scale. But I did it because I thought it would be a necessary resume stop. I did it because I wanted to relearn some of the things in the industry, meet the top people. But then after almost a year, I realized that this was not the right place for me. Guys, I got depressed. I was in a cubicle and it was like WTF after one day, smelling that old musty carpet, filling out the Oracle timesheets, asking myself, what the hell am I doing here? It turns out I worked on some big accounts, had a lot of fun, met some people, but overall it was the longest, toughest year of my life because I was a fish out of water. And it also taught me that where you plant yourself as a talent, just like as a plant or as a tree, is absolutely crucial.
How does one know, first of all, one's primitive attributes, skills? How do you develop them? How do you refine them? And how do you kind of bring them out as a young person when you may feel a little bit insecure in the working world?
Look, I think a couple things. One is to stay hungry. It's not just simply your LinkedIn or your Indeed or your resume. It's also the fire in the belly that employers want to see. They want to see that passion. They want to see that high energy level. But they also want to see that you can play nicely in the sandbox. And I think one of the things about primitive is it's not just for our own self-awareness. It's also to better understand our colleagues. So if I've identified myself as a mutt, I take myself through the roaming acronym. And I say to myself, you know what? I'm pretty relentless. And yes, it's working hard, but sometimes, as you said earlier, when I was back at Burson, it's quitting, it's pivoting, it's doing a 180 and feeling free to do that. Oppositional, for everyone out there, if you're a yes person, not a good thing. There's a tendency to agree with your boss. They want constructive critique. Give it to them in a diplomatic way, but still give it to them. Agnostic is for A, we talked about that. I take pride in being an agnostic primitive and all the different facets of that. M for messianic. You know, this is an interesting one, meaning this is your calling. Yes, I love my day job, but this has to be the first thing I think about when I get up and the last thing that I think about when I put my head on the pillow. And guys, that's been tough because when I first put the word down messianic, I thought, off-putting, sounds like a cult, too religious. What is this? But it's true. I can tell you it's true. Insecure, we talked about. I'm a poster boy for that. Nuts. Yes, some would say growing up in Venice Beach in the 1960s, Drew, made me a little nuts and off the beaten path. And gallant, I try to be, right? Gallant. Favorite interview we did with a woman named Bev Warren, who is a native Lakota speaker in Rapid City, South Dakota. And she teaches Native American nurses to rise to the height of their profession. And one of the things about gallant that people don't realize, they think of primitives, well, they're all cruel, they're all coarse. That's an unevolved primitive. I think an evolved primitive is kind of like more the difference between crude oil and refined oil. And what she's able to do is say, hey, it's not about you. Yes, you got to put your oxygen mask on first when the plane is turbulent, but you got to care about the other. We have one quote in the book on this note that I like a lot from Judith Rich Harris. She wrote a book called The Nurture Assumption. And the punchline is this: the jungle may be bloody, but it is not devoid of love and loyalty.
Greg and I could ask each other questions forever, but let's give the floor over to some Gettysburg College students with truly illuminating questions.
So, Mr. Greenberg, when you talk about, when you say that successful people fake it till they make it, how do these people actually know when they've made it? And when is it time to stop focusing on your insecurities to start focusing on your areas of expertise?
So in terms of the first question, in terms of how they know they've made it, I was pressed on that issue when I have the word successful, most successful in the subtitle of my book. And I quickly had to give an answer on that, which is, yes, it's the monetary, right? We have to support ourselves. But in addition to that, it's big positive impact, right? How can I make the world a better place? You see that in Jim Simons. You see that in a lot of people that I talk about in my book. The other is independence. It could be you work in a big organization, but you don't want a boss breathing down your neck 24/7. You don't want to be micromanaged, right? You want to be able to literally and figuratively roam. And certainly if you start your own thing, you want to do that. And then the last is, in terms of success, and I've had a lot of people tell me this, worth hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, they go, if I'm not having fun, I'm quitting this in a heartbeat. So these people are still having fun.
And I wanted to add one caveat that, like, one thing I've learned in terms of success is try to find some area where you have a competitive advantage. In other words, I heard a speech once by, you know, the book Freakonomics. It's written by two guys, yes. Dubner and Levitt. So Dubner, I think, was one who spoke, and his father was a doctor, and his father was an expert in intestinal gas, stuff that no one else really wanted to deal with. But he was like the world's expert, and he traveled the country and he gave speeches and stuff. And I'm not as smart as some of my colleagues. There are people that write better than I do, but I have a certain niche when it comes to, like, what the big money is doing on Wall Street. There's really no one better. So it's just something that I focus on. So within the journal, there are all kinds of people that do better things than I do, but this one area of expertise, they depend on me for. Greg, there's a rumor that somebody's making a lot of money or losing a lot of money. Can you look into it? Sure. So it's something I enjoy. It took me years to figure this out, but to the extent that everyone keeps an eye out for some area of expertise that maybe you're a little better than everybody else at, that takes you go a long way. Because I could leave my job and I could go do something else and I'd be good, but not great. But one of the reasons I stay is because this is one thing I think I'm better than most at.
I'd like to add, because it's directly on point, one of us writes, when you first went off on your own to start your new company or you started your job, were there any points where you lost confidence in yourself? Were there any point where you thought people had lost confidence in you? And what did you do to right that ship?
So I started at the Journal in 1996. And in 1998, I became really focused on a certain story. And I had surgery in my eye. I had a baby, or my wife had a baby. And I was covering the bond market. It went through a historically bad period. And people at the Journal thought I was doing an awful job covering it. I was doing a bad job, but I wasn't doing a good job. And my boss, sort of tail end of his career, and he wasn't really very involved. He was taking long lunch breaks and stuff. And I went in to ask for a raise. And they said, we were going to send you a warning letter, but you just had a baby, so we decided not to. But that, in effect, was a warning letter, and you don't want to get a warning letter. And I remember thinking to myself that night, I came home, I was like, I think I'm good at this job, and yet they don't think I am. It was so bad that the managing editor at the time, I remember once being in the elevator with him, he wouldn't even look at me in the eyes. I was like persona non grata. And again, I remember thinking, it shouldn't be that way. I legitimately, objectively thought I was pretty good at this. And what I did to climb out and to turn my reputation around, the beautiful thing about my job, and it's true of a lot of jobs, is you can recreate your reputation on a daily basis. We have a daily newspaper. So they can hate you and they think you're the biggest loser in the world and you suck at your job, But if you come up with a scoop tomorrow, you're a hero. It's almost like in sports kind of thing. There are a lot of sports analogies, but like, and you can be a big slump, but if you had a big home run, you can't take that off the point off the board. So I just thought, I'm just going to do good work and see what happens. And within a short amount of time, within a few years, I was like a star. And then a few years after that, they were literally like holding my stories up in front of company events saying, we need more stories like that. But I'll never forget that feeling of being the loser at the Wall Street Journal. And now I'm a superstar, but I don't feel like a superstar ever because I went through that experience. Maybe that's healthy, but I guess the lesson there is anybody can go through ups and downs and do poor jobs. And some of it was my fault. Some of it wasn't, but the lesson there is just, you can turn your careers around, just do good work. And then they can't help but notice it is generally a meritocracy out there. If you do good work in whatever profession it is, I do think you will be appreciated, maybe not within your own company, but somewhere else. So just sort of try to push on and do good work, I guess, would be the lesson.
That was author and journalist Greg Zuckerman. His books are The Man Who Solved the Market, The Frackers, and The Greatest Trade Ever, just to name a few. Huge thanks to him for stopping by, and as always, thanks to Professor Murphy and the students of Gettysburg College. Primitive Moves is hosted by me, Marco Greenberg, and produced by Caroline Glennon and Robert Scaramuccia. Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Until next week, keep trusting your primal instinct.